Welcome to Golau, where we shed some light on politics, policy and polling in Wales and the world. On the 6th of July 2017, the Wales Governance Centre hosted its regular post-election briefing. This episode of Golau features Professor Roger Scully's presentation on understanding the 2017 UK general election.
So, talk about the election this year. And I thought what I should do to start off with is to establish some firm basis for understanding this election, set out some of the most certain knowledge that we have about elections, the product of years, in some cases decades, of diligent research. There's established some of the things which are, you know, are clearly the case, the most well-verified knowledge that we have about elections in general and elections in the UK in particular. And this, I think, will be of great benefit to us in understanding what happened in 2017. So I thought I'd just talk through, I think, four particular things. First of all, it's been established very clearly through large amounts of comparative research that in Britain and indeed in other established democracies, the official campaign period generally sees very little change in party support. My good friend, the American scholar Chris Valesian, has described the short campaign period as he's talked about, you know, the pre-baked cake, that, you know, attitudes to parties, party support has largely been set over the ensuing years and months. And during the actual campaign itself, there's an awful lot of activity by the parties, but generally speaking, not much changes. The analogy I would use, which possibly suggests that I've been in Wales for a little bit too long, is with a rugby scrum, where you have these two great masses of humanity shoving against each other with all their might and normally getting nowhere, maybe just collapsing in the mud. So not much changes during the campaign. That's been very well established across multiple studies. Secondly, I think we know through numerous previous examples that divided parties do not prosper in general elections. My undergraduate lecturer, the legendary Professor David Denver, used to say with, I think, a pardonable degree of exaggeration, that it would be better for a party to be united around a policy of slaughtering the firstborn than it would be for them to be openly divided in election. And I think it's important for understanding this year's general election, where the major opposition party entered the election with a leader who had been publicly disowned or, you know, expressed a lack of confidence in him by an overwhelming majority of his party colleagues. You know, the Labour Party had very clearly and publicly been divided for much of the previous 2 years, you know, the lifetime of this parliament. Thirdly, it's been established pretty clearly by previous examples that the Labour Party does not do well, does not prosper in general elections when it's led from the left. Most obviously seen in 1983, but also to possibly a somewhat lesser extent, other leaders who to some degree had been or were identified with the left, such as Neil Kinnock, maybe even like 2015 Ed Miliband, elected as the somewhat more left-wing Miliband brother. Labour Party has not done well in elections when it's been led from the left. And finally, very clearly established is that two-party politics has been in long-term decline. The general elections in the 1950s, the four general elections in that decade, I believe it's the case that in every one of them, certainly the Britain-wide vote share of the Labour Party and the Conservatives combined was always 90% or above. Since then, the roughly half century or so since then, there's been a not quite linear but fairly clear decline in the dominance of the Conservative and Labour parties put together. Reaching in 2010 the point where Labour and Conservative between them won less than two-thirds of the vote. So all of these things have been very well established. These are what we thought we knew about elections in the UK. So what actually happened? I'm going to look in some detail at the results, but start off just with a couple of slides on the opinion polls, Britain-wide. So this is basically every single Britain-wide opinion poll throughout the lifetime of the last parliament. The solid lines here basically are the trend lines. The individual dots are the individual polls. And you can see from this, first and most obviously, that the Conservatives were always ahead throughout the entire lifetime of this, albeit truncated, Parliament. That's extremely unusual. We do see something of a dip in Conservative support in spring last year. This was the time of the unpopular budget, the Ian Duncan-Smith resignation, the junior doctors' strike, the Panama Papers fiasco and things like that. But even then, the Conservatives were still ahead. Theresa May becomes Prime Minister around this time. There's a sort of honeymoon period which proves remarkably resilient. And then we see, as the election is called, a substantial upward spike in Conservative support. The Labour Party was never ahead. Jeremy Corbyn is elected there. If you squint very hard, you can see the Corbyn bounce. But basically, the Labour Party is flatlining until May becomes Prime Minister. And then it's broadly trending downwards towards just the mid-20s, around 25% at the start of the election campaign. Meanwhile, UKIP support started to edge downwards after Theresa May became Prime Minister. And the hashtag Lib Dem fight back, I think it's there, if you squint very closely. But what I'm interested in particularly is what happens here. And if we, and in particular this very substantial change, which if we expand that into just a graph of the campaign polling, this looks rather less spectacular, but is still nonetheless, I think, very significant. I mean, the Conservatives, doing really well at the start of the election campaign, close to 50% support on average, maintaining that level for some time until well into May, and then starting to trend downwards. But the major change we see here is an almost continuous, indeed not far short of linear, steady upward movement in Labour Party support. And this deeply divided party actually adding significant support during the course of the campaign. Albeit the final polls, on average, still somewhat underestimated Labour support and marginally overstated Conservative support. The other things we see here, well, the Lib Dems starting moderately and then tailing off, and of course UKIP doing very poorly indeed. And that led us to the following result, unexpected by many people, including by me. One or two things to notice here. For the second successive general election, the Labour Party saw its vote share rise by almost twice as much as for the Conservatives. The same was actually true in 2015, but in 2015 the Conservatives were spectacularly successful at getting the votes where they needed them, and Labour, frankly, was spectacularly unsuccessful at doing that. This time round, Labour was actually rather better at getting the votes in the right places. So the Conservatives, very unusually, added 5.5 percentage points to their vote share from 2 years ago, yet had a net loss of seats. That doesn't happen very often. But the Labour Party, with this substantial increase in vote share, saw themselves going significantly above 250 seats and, crucially, denying the Conservatives their parliamentary majority. Elsewhere, of course, we see the SNP maintaining their position as the clear third party in the Parliament, albeit losing significant ground. The Lib Dems, a few more seats, but amazingly even fewer votes, or even lower vote share in 2015. And Greens fading away from last time, UKIP fading away really quite spectacularly. So a few things to think about in general about these UK-wide results. First of all, this was the second successive election, but also only the second time it has ever happened that in the four nations of the UK, four different parties came first. So Northern Ireland was the DUP, Scotland the SNP, Wales was Labour, England the Conservatives. Now, there was, as I'll show in a second, some modest convergence in electoral behaviour of Scotland and Wales becoming a bit more like England. There's also a point I'll return to at the end in terms of campaigning. Arguably, the election was more differentiated across the different nations of the UK than ever before. This is a dissimilarity index. If I can just explain this, this index potentially runs from 0 to 100. 0 would be where the same party's got exactly the same share of the vote in the different nations of Britain. 100 would be, say, where parties who got all the votes in Scotland got no votes at all in England. Now, I charted this all the way through from 1945. Yeah, it fills the long winter evenings. and basically, the dark line is Scotland, the lighter grey line is Wales. We can see here that Wales basically has had a certain degree of electoral distinctiveness from England throughout the entire post-war period. It reached its peak in 1992, when Labour performed disproportionately well in Wales, but then, you know, they were led by the Welshman Neil Kinnock, so perhaps that's not surprising. Since then, there's been a very gentle but continual trend in terms of Wales becoming more like England in its general election voting behaviour, and that continued in 2017. Scotland used to be much more like England than Wales was. That changed in 1974, and at every general election since, Scotland has been more different to England than Wales has. But in 2015, this line almost sort of went right up the top of the chart. With the decline somewhat of the SNP, the revival of, in particular, the Scottish Conservatives this year, Scotland's become somewhat less electorally distinct from England, but still quite substantially different. A second key point from the UK results is this long-term trend for more than half a century of the decline in two-party dominance suddenly went into reverse, and went into reverse quite significantly. This next chart goes again all the way back to 1945. Purple here is not UKIP share of the vote, in case you were thinking you don't remember that from history classes. This is combined Conservative and Labour share of the vote. So back in the 1950s, almost everyone voting Conservative or Labour. The broad trend since then has been for this to go downwards, hitting thus far an all-time low in 2010. Modest revival in 2015, but then a much more substantial revival in two-party dominance this year. This is the highest two-party vote share since 1970. So almost in almost 50 years. A big part of this, of course, has been the decline in this yellow bit. The Alliance Liberals, now Liberal Democrats, doing much less well. But this time, of course, also substantial decline in the vote share of others. That's less vote share for the SNP, less for the Greens, and a lot less for UKIP. Third point on the UK-wide results, largely because of this reassertion of two-party dominance, the operation of the electoral system this year also became much less disproportional. We know with first past the post, it's tended to discriminate against smaller parties, except when, as in the case of the SNP, their support is geographically concentrated. And so what we've seen since the rise of the Liberals, later Liberal Democrats in the 1970s, has been a general trend towards increased disproportionality. You know, the match between the share of votes and share of seats has been less exact. But this year, it came much closer back into alignment again. I'm afraid I only did this one back to 1951. Sorry, I feel a bit of a slacker. We need some more long winter evenings. But basically, this is the Gallagher Index of Disproportionality. Again, potentially runs from 0 to 100. 0 is where the percentage votes and percentage seats exactly match for all parties. 100 is the somewhat unlikely scenario where all seats go to parties that win none of the votes. In practice, anything in double figures is quite significant disproportionality. And you see, during the era of two-party dominance, we had relatively low disproportionality, a big upward spike in 1974, and then, you know, quite significant disproportionality in every election since, but back down this year into single figures, the lowest figure again since 1970. And that is more or less the direct result of the reassertion of two-party dominance. So the electoral system is working in a less distorting manner than it used to do. And now I'd like to talk about the results in Wales a little bit. First of all, this is a chart with the Welsh polls. I don't need a trend line on here because this has basically all of them from the start of the campaign. So we had one here, and then the next three along here. And basically we saw, and it caused a lot of interest at the time, the first poll showing a 10-point Conservative lead. This was very much in line with the Britain-wide spike in Conservative support that we're seeing at the beginning of the general election campaign. It seemed as if Theresa May's gambit of focusing this election on Brexit was doing well everywhere, and possibly doing particularly well in Wales, which of course had voted for Brexit. As I say, that poll caused something of a sensation. It was even reported, I was told, in the Times of India, whose coverage, I believe, of Welsh opinion polls, and I hope I'm not being unfair to the Times of India, but I believe their coverage of Welsh opinion polls is less than thorough in most circumstances. But anyway, got a lot of interest. Conservatives maintained their lead in the second poll, albeit the Labour already fighting back. But then, time of our third poll, which was sort of mid-May, Labour moving back into the lead. And that turned out not to be any sort of fluke poll because they maintained and indeed improved their position subsequently. The other parties, of course, all getting squeezed. UKIP, who got more than 13% of the vote in 2015, getting squeezed harder than a lemon in a crowded lift. But Plaid Cymru also generally trending downwards during the campaign up until the very end. And the Lib Dems, doing so well. In fact, their line disappears behind the purple one there. And that produced these results in Wales, which I'll talk about in relation to the parties individually more in a second. But basically, really strong performance from Labour, again, increasing their vote share more or less twice as much as the Conservatives did. Conservatives, amazingly, adding more than 6 percentage points onto their vote share from 2 years ago, and yet coming out with a net loss of 3 seats. That doesn't happen very often. Plaid Cymru, as I'll talk about in a second, getting away with it perhaps. Poor vote share, but decent performance and outcome. Everyone else doing badly. Again, the big change here, the enormous decline in UKIP vote share from just 2 years ago. So what I'd like to do now is just talk a little bit about the parties in Wales, look at them individually and their results and how they did. And I'll start, because this is Wales and we always start with Labour, so I'll start with the Labour Party. That's entirely warranted because the Labour Party have, as most of you here know, for a very long time been the dominant political party here. This was the 26th successive election in Wales where the Labour Party won the most votes and the most seats. The one that started in 1922. So next year will be the centenary of the last general election in Wales that Labour didn't win. So I hope you're all planning your parties for that now. This was actually as well Labour's highest vote share in Wales since 1997, since the spectacular first Tony Blair landslide. So even their enormous victory in 2001, again under Tony Blair, when he was still popular, they weren't getting as high a vote share then as in Wales as they did this year, which is, I think, a pretty extraordinary figure. And Labour's vote share declined in not a single seat of the 40 constituencies in Wales. Nor did Labour lose a single deposit in Wales. Note here their highest and lowest vote shares. We look at individual seats. These are the five constituencies where Labour had their best vote share changes from last time. These are the five where they had their worst. Interesting to note, three of the five best in Cardiff. Just as we saw in the council elections back in the beginning of May, the Labour Party in Wales' capital city doing really well. And of course, our parliamentary representation in Cardiff now is once again entirely Labour. No particularly obvious patterns of places where Labour didn't do quite so well. But even here, their fifth worst vote share change in Wales was an almost 10 percentage point rise. That's not a bad sort of position to be in. For the Conservatives, this was their highest Welsh vote share since 1935. They exactly equaled their performance in that year. They ended up losing seats. Only one seat where the Conservative vote share declined. And as with Labour, Conservatives also didn't lose a single deposit anywhere in Wales. Even in some of those valley seats where the Conservatives have often seemed somewhat less popular than a mass cholera epidemic, they still saved their deposit everywhere. Note their highest vote share and lowest vote share. Okay, the ones are keeping up some long traditions there. We look at where the Conservatives did relatively best. With the exception of Swansea East, most of these and the next two or three in this list are either in north-east or south-east Wales. Again, these are places where UKIP did particularly well 2 years ago. Of course, we're seeing that big collapse in the UKIP vote. The only place where the Conservative vote share declined, the seat they were defending, Cardiff North, which, of course, they lost Other places, well, it's really interesting. Their five worst vote shares, all in seats the Conservatives held. Now, quite what that says, I'm not entirely sure. It does perhaps suggest, though, the Conservatives are not doing a particularly good job of communicating to their constituents. Because we certainly ain't seeing much incumbency bonus here for the Conservatives in seats they were holding. And particularly, you know, Cardiff North, you normally see the first time round a sitting member is defending a seat, have a particularly positive vote share change. Now, OK, you know, Craig Williams had only had 2 years in Cardiff North rather than a full parliamentary term. But to see, you know, your worst vote share change in a seat where you have an incumbent defending for the first time is really very unusual. And I think the Conservative Party in Wales needs to think about why its relatively worst performances were all in its own territory. For Plaid Cymru, this was their lowest vote share in a Welsh general election for 30 years. There's no very positive way to spin that. And their vote share increased in only six seats out of the 14 Wales. Moreover, in not far short of half the seats in Wales, the would-be Party of Wales didn't even get the 5% needed to retain its deposit. You know, there were a lot of places where Plaid was performing really spectacularly poorly. Well, it's the highest vote share and lowest vote share there. If we look at its best vote share changes, Blenheim Gwent has had some fairly strange electoral things happening to it in recent times. This was, of course, Labour's relatively worst performing seat. And Plaid did pretty well there. In Durham Meirionnydd, of course, Liz Saville-Roberts was defending the seat for the first time, starting to see some benefits from incumbency, perhaps. Other than that, you know, Ceredigion, a small but, as it turned out, extremely significant vote share increase. And I should just mention this fifth one, because that was Aled Morgan Hughes, our Wales Governance Centre PhD student. So I must mention him. He's obviously taken careful notes over the years. But if you look at some of the places where these worst vote share changes, OK, you know, the vote isn't collapsing through the floor, but in some of these places, you know, it wasn't a great deal further. It could have fallen anyway. And some of these, you know, Wandsworth, Llanelli, these are seats where Plaid have, either this year or in very recent times, been talking up their chances of winning. Cardiff West was a place where they had one of their best performances in the Assembly election last year, and yet these are places where this year Plaid were doing, you know, relatively worst. So I think, again, you know, Plaid need to look at how effective they're being at getting the votes out in the sort of places where they're targeting. For the Liberal Democrats, well, you know, lots of people, including me, thought that 2015 was as bad as it could possibly get. And they managed to lose a further 2 percentage points on the already pathetic 6.5% vote share they won 2 years ago. Yet again, as we saw in the Europeans in 2014, as we saw also in the last general election, Wales was the worst performing British nation for the Liberal Democrats. They had a lower vote share here than they did either in Scotland or in England. And indeed, their vote share increased in only two seats. Brecon and Radnor, well, understandable, I suppose. It's the base of Kirsty Williams, where she did very well last year. Somewhat more mysteriously, Preseli Pembrokeshire. I'm not quite sure what's going on there. Everywhere else, their vote share was down. Everywhere else. And they've become effectively a four-seat party in Wales. I mean, they lost 36 deposits. There's only four seats where the Liberal Democrats were even doing respectably well. You know, this is a party that was winning over 20% of the vote in Wales just 7 years ago. And indeed, 7 years ago, they were in double figures in terms of vote share in every seat in Wales by Ynys Môn. Highest vote share, Brecon and Radnor. Lowest vote share, the Rhondda, they couldn't even manage 1% of the votes. And if we look at some of their worst vote share changes, their worst one, their key target seat of Cardiff Central. Some of these others, you know, Ceredigion, the one seat they were defending. Places like Pontypridd and Swansea West, where they were scoring, you know, very solid, respectable second places just two general elections ago. And of course, their former seat in Montgomeryshire, who I guess possibly, you know, the curse of Lembit continues to have some influence. It's very difficult to find anything at all positive to say about the Liberal Democrats' performance, except at least it wasn't as bad as UKIP. That's about the best thing you can say. For UKIP, they lost more than 5/6 of the vote share they'd had just 2 years ago. And 2 years ago, I mean, UKIP stood 2 years ago in every single Welsh seat, and every single UKIP candidate in Wales saved their deposit. There was a quite spectacular contrast that 2 years ago with Scotland, where in Scotland every single UKIP candidate lost their deposit. But here, this time round, they stood in 32 of the 40 seats and every single candidate lost their deposit. So you go from performing pretty well everywhere to performing dreadfully everywhere. Once again, as 2 years ago, their highest vote share, I'm sure it will please the former member Neil Kinnock, their highest vote share was in Sloane. Lowest vote share in Cardiff Central. But, you know, I mean, what we're seeing here in terms of their lowest vote shares, these are basically places where they did relatively well, but they had furthest to fall. And they were falling quite a long way. Right. So how do we make sense of all of this? Well, that's going to be quite a long-term job, I think, trying to puzzle this out. A lot of the detailed survey data that people like me will spend a long time analysing hasn't come through yet. So I'm just going to offer a few thoughts about interpreting this general election, necessarily somewhat tentative in nature, and hopefully we can discuss some of them. First of all, I mean, this was supposed to be the Brexit election. That's very much how Theresa May sought to focus it. This made a great deal of sense. Brexit was clearly an important issue. It, at the very least, gave the Conservatives a strong pretext for calling an election they looked likely to win anyway. And you look at some of the survey data, fighting on the territory of Brexit seemed likely to play to the advantage of the Conservatives. Indeed, if we look at data from just before the election about both about the salience of Brexit and where the parties ranked, this focus of the election should have played to the Conservatives' advantage. So one of the things we asked in all the Welsh Political Barometer polls was also asked in some of the Britain-wide polls that showed a very similar picture, was just how important an issue was Brexit compared to other issues in the election. So this is from the final Welsh poll done in June. And this just identifies, we asked people what's, you know, name up to three important issues in this election. So the percentages here add up to more than 100 because people could name more than one issue. I've only listed the four most commonly named issues here because there are lots of other things. But clearly, and this was consistent in all the Welsh polls, also seen very clearly in the Britain-wide polling, is that you ask people what's the most important issue and Brexit came up consistently as the most commonly named issue. Ahead of, you know, for instance, imaginable two general elections ago, the economy was only consistently the fourth most important issue. Had, even in Wales, and yes, I know it's a devolved issue and everything, health actually normally coming out as the second most important issue, immigration coming out normally as the third most important issue. But consistently and clearly, Brexit being named as the most important issue by more people than any other. So, you know, this focus on the Conservatives' chosen territory should have helped them. And it particularly should have helped them because when we asked people which parties are best placed to handle these issues, on Brexit, look at the ratings of the parties, the Conservatives consistently came out ahead. So which party is best able to handle this? This was the last time we asked this, you know, barometer poll right at the very end of May. Okay, lots of people said no party or some other party or don't know. But of those who named a party, the Conservatives had a consistent and substantial lead in the handling of Brexit. So in a sense, this makes the election outcome all the more puzzling. You know, the Conservatives started off with huge opinion poll leads, and on the territory of their choosing, well, you know, the public, first of all, believed their pitch or accepted their pitch that this was, in significant elements, a Brexit election, and the Conservatives were the most popularly rated party on Brexit. Yet, Conservatives ended up significantly underperforming. What on earth is that about? Well, I think that's going to take some puzzling out. Part of the answer, I suspect, though, will be revealed by the next couple of slides. We look at leadership, because as well as promising to deliver on Brexit, the other key element of the Conservative appeal was, and you can probably all chant it in unison with me now, strong and stable leadership. This was repeated like some sort of mantra, to the point where I'm sure even the people saying it had got to the point where the thought of saying it one more time made them want to vomit. But the Conservatives thought this was a key advantage to them. Consistently, since she'd become Prime Minister, Theresa May had been enjoying very positive poll ratings and was, in particular, a very long way ahead of Jeremy Corbyn. No matter how you asked about leadership, Theresa May always did much better than Jeremy Corbyn. And this next chart shows how we asked about this in the Welsh Political Barometer polls. We basically just asked people to put the leaders on a 0 to 10 scale, where 0 means strongly dislike, 10 means strongly like. Okay, liking is not necessarily the same as believing somebody will be a competent prime minister. But in practice, we found that these liking ratings correlate extremely highly with other ways of asking about party leaders, like, you know, which would be the best prime minister or whatever. So this is a pretty good measure of leader popularity. Now, this light blue line is Theresa May. First Welsh poll, this sensational one in late April. Theresa May is the most popular politician in Wales. An English Conservative Prime Minister is clearly the most popular politician in Wales. You know, at the time, that, you know, if we'd been running polls long enough, I'm sure we'd have found that that was unprecedented. A significant lead over the next two most popular politicians, Carwyn Jones, who's this dark line, and Leanne Wood, who's the green line. And then this red one, this is Jeremy Corbyn. So Theresa May had a lead on average popularity ratings of well over a point on a 0 to 10 scale ahead of Jeremy Corbyn. So, of course, the Conservatives were focusing on leadership. You know, you would have to have been spectacularly stupid not to do so. This, it seemed, was a key advantage to theirs, you know, even in historic Labour territory like Wales, and so they were going to play it for all it was worth. Except that doesn't work quite so well if your leader starts to become significantly less popular. And what we see over the course of the campaign is, you know, Leanne Wood continuing to do quite well, Carwyn Jones doing well, and of course, you know, he was given a very prominent role in the campaign by the Labour Party in Wales. But Theresa May, this light blue line, just trending downwards, going from averaging less 5 out of 10 to below 4 in the course of about 6 weeks. So a big loss in popularity for Theresa May, and also a big gain in popularity for Jeremy Corbyn, going from being clearly the most unpopular leader to rivaling Carwyn Jones, averaging almost 5 out of 10. So we see a huge transformation in the relative popularity of May versus Corbyn. And so that something which seemed like an obvious call for the Conservatives back in April, highlight this contrast between May and Corbyn, actually started to play much less well for them. Final thing I'd just like to mention, I talked about it very briefly at the beginning. One of the things we saw in this election, I think, was a further step towards the hollowing out of a genuinely British party politics. That is, you know, I mean, elections are all about choices, you know, choosing from a menu of options. The parties are what provides the menu of options, and though we might not always be wildly impressed by the menu, you know, those are the choices we have. It used to be largely the case that that menu of options was pretty common across the different nations of the UK. I think increasingly we've been seeing that becoming less so. And this year, I mean, I think there was a significant step further in that process. In Scotland, the election campaign, just as it was in 2015, seemed largely disconnected from the rest of the general election. This became a general election about NDUF2, or whether we should have NDUF2. An enormous amount of focus on that. In particular, you know, the Scottish Conservatives have a significant comeback. I mean, I think it's been somewhat overplayed by the media. The Scottish Conservatives still have not much more than one-third the number of MPs as the SNP do. But nonetheless, to the extent that they made a comeback, the Scottish Conservatives did it not by focusing on Theresa May, but by focusing on the leadership of Ruth Davidson and her opposition to another independence referendum. And in Wales, we had Jeremy Corbyn, until the very end of the campaign, at least, very much airbrushed out of the Labour campaign, and a big focus on Carwyn Jones as the main face and voice of the Labour campaign. Yeah. Labour in Wales had, it seemed, we'd seen in last year's Assembly election, this year's council election, Labour in Wales had shown that it could still win, even in difficult times, if it ran as Welsh Labour. And that was the overwhelming focus of the Labour campaign here. So we've seen actually a greater differentiation of the menus of options that people have in the different nations of the UK. I think that's a really important and fundamental development, and possibly one we can discuss. But anyway, that's, I think, enough from me for now. Thanks for your patience, and I guess we move into the Q&A. Diolch.
In the show notes of this episode, you'll find a link to Professor Roger Scully's blog, as well as a link to the video of this event on YouTube. Thanks for listening to Golay, a Cardiff University podcast. Subscribe in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from to have the next episode download automatically.